is a can of Campbell's soup. There's in the can of Campbell's soup, there's about 2.6 pennies worth of steel. So if that goes up by 25%, that's about 0.6 cents on the price of a can of Campbell's soup. Well, I just bought this can today at a 7-Eleven down here, and the price was $1.99. So who in the world is going to be too bothered by 0.6 cents?
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross on CNBC today offering his assurances that the Trump administration's new tariffs on steel and aluminum won't cause much pain, at least for consumers. President Trump tweeted this morning, "Trade wars are good and easy to win." Well, reaction to his unexpected move has been swift. The stock market took a dive after the announcement yesterday, and it's trending downward again today. Our big trading partners, the European Union, Canada, China, are crying foul and warning that they might retaliate. But some union workers and their supporters say it's about time they got some help with competition from overseas. We're going to talk about all this with Jared Bernstein. He's senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and he was economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden during President Obama's first term. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Andrew Rastusha. He is White House reporter for Politico. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Andrew, will these tariffs really go through next week as promised?
The president has said he's going to do it, but there's about 7 days now where everyone in this White House that opposes this and everyone on the outside, including a number of Republicans, including the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, have the opportunity to try to change his mind. So it's a real possibility that these things could change over the next 7 days.
And strange that Democrats or some Democrats seem to be okay with this. Sherrod Brown, for example, senator from Ohio, and also Chuck Schumer has been in favor of this, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a total role reversal from the normal reaction that you get from a President Trump's policy announcements. You have a lot of Democrats generally saying this is something that we should have done a long time ago. And you have Republicans crying foul.
And Jared, will this help the American steelworker? Will it help blue-collar workers in these Rust Belt states?
Well, actually, those are two different groups. So it will help steel and aluminum workers a little bit. There's actually significant unused capacity in those sectors. So there's factories in Ohio that are at least partially idle. And these kinds of tariffs typically do increase domestic production in the industries that are targeted. However, there are a lot of blue-collar workers who work in all kinds of other industries wherein steel and aluminum are inputs. And that means that those inputs are now more expensive, so some of those price increases bleed through. Soup, people who make Campbell's soup, for example, although the numbers that Wilbur Ross cited are correct, so even if this pass-through does occur, it's not going to be dramatic. But that's only part of what's at stake here.
So what is the other part?
Well, I think the biggest concern is that there will be retaliation from our trade partners who are very unhappy with these tariffs. Typically, and this kind of thing goes on all the time, I think people probably don't know it, but it's true, we're always targeting some narrow aspect of international trade with tariffs, and so are other countries. It might be rubber tires grade 4, some really obscure thing you've never heard of, but there's a tariff on it. But this is different. This is a very broad tariff on everyone with whom we trade, everyone with whom we import steel and aluminum from. And we're already hearing from the Canadians and the Germans and the Chinese. They're all very unhappy about this. And if we see a significant disruption to global trade, that will be more of an economic event than those small price effects that Ross was talking about.
Right. And so they could target all sorts of different industries. Where would they look, do you think, to retaliate?
Anything that they export to us. So Canada is actually we get commodities, steel, agriculture from Canada. We get pretty much everything, especially all the kinds of low-wage goods you see in Walmart from China, electronic goods. I mean, that's the thing. Once you start going very broad with these kinds of measures, remember, it's interesting. We're not as exposed to this sort of thing as some other countries. We probably import about 15% of our GDP. If you look at a country in Europe, it's going to be at least twice that magnitude. But still, that's a lot of GDP.
Yeah. Okay, so Andrew, I know that inside the White House, there was a big war in terms of whether or not to go through with this with, you know, the Gary Cohns on one side and the Peter Navarros on the other side. How come the free traders lost out?
At the end of the day, this is something that Trump's believed for a long time. I mean, he's basically a protectionist. He has long made the case that the U.S. is not getting a fair deal on the international stage. And this dates back decades. So it was always going to be a difficult fight for people like Gary Cohn, who, you know, has made a, you know, pretty strong case behind the scenes that this could be an economic disaster. You know, but the president is increasingly isolated. He's increasingly frustrated, and he wants to make a splash, and he wants to live up to the campaign promises that he made in 2016.
Well, President George W. Bush tried the same thing, and it didn't work. Can you talk about that?
Sure, yeah. In 2002, the President George W. Bush put forward tariffs on steel, and it was under a different law, and sort of the conditions were slightly different, but you know, he did a kind of a generally similar thing, and eventually the next year he ended up, you know, repealing those sanctions. And I'm sure, Jared, you could speak to this too.
These things are almost always temporary, so the fact that they might end in a year or two is not at all unexpected. And I think what eventually happened was the Team Bush evaluated that the tariffs weren't necessary anymore. But as Andrew suggests, there's good questions whether they did any good at all. I think it was kind of like the scenario I described earlier. You did probably help those sectors that were directly targeted a bit. But I think the key thing on the economics to realize here is that steel and aluminum are inputs into so many other industries that you ding them as well. I would like to say one thing about the politics. Andrew's covering that extremely well. But let me add one thing. There is this real problem in the American political economy right now, which is that there are a significant swath of workers in our country who haven't been helped by globalization the way Democrats and Republicans have advertised for decades. They've been hurt by globalization. We're well aware of this now because Donald Trump, you know, really very acutely tuned into that dissatisfaction in ways that kind of blew the lid off of this consensus that left and right maintained for so many years, that nobody ever gets hurt by trade. Well, that was demonstrably wrong. Sure, the benefits outweigh the costs for the nation as a whole, but there are groups who have been hurt. And I don't think either side has offered much of an agenda to help those folks. So here you see Donald Trump doing something that I don't think is going to be particularly helpful, but it is an area where there needs to be more smarter policy than exists as we speak.
And we're a service economy by and large now, and we have been for many, many years. So how is this going to affect the service part of our economy?
There's only about maybe 10 or 9% of our employment is in manufacturing. So to the extent that this raises costs throughout the economy, puts a bit more pressure on prices, is a bit more inflationary, it could have impacts on consumers' wallets. But again, that's not just a function of the tariffs we're talking about that today. That would be a matter of the sort of large-scale retaliation that people are warning about.
Right. And so people are saying they're citing Smoot-Hawley from 1930, which really deepened the Great Depression.
That's an overreaction.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
The economy is actually doing much better than it was in the Great Depression. In fact, we're doing pretty well. So my view is that depending on how much things escalate, these tariffs can be absorbed without a lot of pain, but we'll have to see.
Yeah. And Andrew, paint a larger political picture for us, if you will. You saw the president basically spouting some gun control policies that Democrats have pushed for earlier this week, and now you see this. What is happening with him politically, and how's the Republican leadership going to handle him going forward? Have they decided that he is an unreliable partner and they'll just do what they want, or do they hope to bring him back into the fold?
This president is, you talk to people in his White House, they don't often, you know, nobody's going to say on any given day. He basically, at this point, is wanting to do something that's going to make a splash. And he definitely got that with the tariffs.
Jared, just looking forward, you mentioned that there's a real problem with significant swaths of workers hurt by globalization and their concerns not being addressed. Is anybody in either political party putting forth a viable proposal to help these people?
Well, that's a really important question, and we're starting to see a little bit of it. I can speak to that, but I did want to make one point about the legislation that I think is important for listeners to recognize. The president can can implement these tariffs without Congress. On the policies, we definitely see Democrats, Chuck Schumer on down, they recognize, and I know because I've talked to them about it, that this is something missing, that they don't have a compelling, understandable agenda that people who've been hurt by globalization, a minority of our workforce, but not a trivial one, they recognize the need. And one of the things they're thinking about, just to put some policy meat on these bones, is some sort of direct job creation program. That is, if the market isn't creating the employment opportunities for some of these folks who've been left behind, then there needs to be some sort of subsidization of employment in their area.
Jared Bernstein, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Andrew Rastusha, he's White House reporter for Politico. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Joining us now is Catherine Houston. She's the California Political Director for United Steelworkers. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what do you make of Trump's tariffs?
Well, we are pretty excited to hear about this. We feel that we've been under attack by these predatory practices for quite some time now. So we're thrilled to see that things are hopefully moving in the right direction with this.
And how many workers do you think this will help?
This will help for our steel workers here in California, probably between 1,200 and 1,700 workers that, depend upon this industry for their livelihoods. So that's very positive news for us.
So how would it actually help them? Would it mean that more people would be hired? Would they be getting more hours or what?
What we hope it translates to is that because they've been under attack for so long because of the overcapacity, steel dumping, things like that, we've been in a situation where rather than grow those industries, there's been a series of layoffs as production needs to slow down because of the competitiveness of the issue. And so we've needed to make sure that we reverse this situation. And so what we hope this will translate to is once again increasing our numbers of workers that we can have in these jobs, that, you know, these are family sustaining jobs. And additionally, then we will be able to have folks hopefully invest more. It works across the board. The companies have more productivity. They are able to pour more dollars into their infrastructure, which increases that capacity as well. And it just is a cyclical process that creates more jobs overall. And it lifts the community up, of course, as well.
The United Steelworkers endorsed Hillary Clinton for president in 2016. So would this go perhaps to changing your mind about President Trump as he seeks re-election?
I can't presume to, because we haven't completed our processes, that's really part of our political education group that goes through those processes. And so what I would say is that when we look at it, we are an issue-based group. And so we base our endorsements on how people shake out on a variety of our core issues as it relates to the industries that we represent. And so that's how we determine our support as an organization overall. And so I think what we are happy to see here is that this is something that speaks to the infrastructure and the fabric of our country and who we are as Americans. And this, you know, steel has always been a true blue American industry.
Catherine Houston, California Political Director for United Steelworkers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, feral cows are tearing up a national monument in the California desert. Oh, and there are some feral pit bulls there, too. Get out your hiking boots or maybe your fastest running shoes. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you're planning a hike or a camping trip around Santa Snow National Monument near Palm Springs, well, watch out for the angry feral cattle. That's right. Around 150 wild cows and bulls are trampling these public lands. They're charging at hikers. They're threatening the habitats of some endangered species. And that's not all. There's also a pack of wild pit bulls roaming around, and they've been known to kill and eat the wild cattle. The circle of life? Well, Louis Sahagun is a reporter for the LA Times. We read about this. Hi.
Hi there.
Okay, first, where did the cattle come from?
The cattle are believed to be descendants of herds that roamed that region over a century ago. And until recently, fairly recently, they were believed to be, you know, in small groups here and there, a half dozen here or there in the high country, the San Bernardino Mountains. The trouble is that all of a sudden, there's this very large number that's descended over 150 into this brand new national monument, Santa Snow, and the Whitewater Preserve area. Cattle, cows are one thing, but one-third of this particular group of animals are bulls, up to 2,000 pounds each, and they are incredibly defensive,
yeah.
Or I should say aggressive.
And they have horns, right?
They have horns over a foot long and seemingly hard as iron.
Ooh.
You know, it's more than a threat to that gorgeous environment. They're laying waste to it. The damage in just a few years is profound. They eat, acres upon acres of grasslands have been eaten down to bare dirt.
So, of course,
you don't want to run into one around the mountain along the trail.
And some hikers have run into them, right?
Hikers have. People who maintain a 30-mile-long stretch of the Pacific Crest Trail that runs through that area, 30 miles long. It's one of the most popular wilderness trails in the entire state of California. And yes, there have been run-ins.
And so I guess one would ponder, if they have descended into this national monument and there are so many more of them now, did they used to have natural predators that are no longer around to kill them off?
Actually, this is an area that's it's got a remarkable array of wildlife, including mountain lion and bobcats, but also bears. But these cattle, being wild, have developed a behavior that experts have compared to the kind of behavior you would expect to see from, say, elk herds in the wilderness. You know, you can't go out and corral them. They're dispersed over some of the steepest slopes in Southern California. They can be elusive. They can also be aggressive. They don't behave like domesticated cattle.
Mm. Okay, so they're not going to quietly line up for the slaughter. Speaking of that,
well, that's one way to put it.
let's bring up the pit bull angle here. How did that happen? A feral group of pit bulls.
Again, like the cattle, no one is exactly sure where they came from, but they showed up over the last year, and some hikers in the area, and again, some of the people who maintain the trails, have actually witnessed, to their astonishment, these dogs explode out of the brush and take down cattle and then eat them. And as Jack Thompson of the Whitewater Preserve, which is adjacent to the 100,000-acre monument, as he put it to me, only half kidding, he said, man, it's Jurassic Park just 2 hours east of downtown Los Angeles.
That's terrifying. So as a hiker, should I be more afraid of the cattle, the bulls with the horns, or the pit bulls, or both?
That's very... That's an impossible question to answer. You know, I, for one, would be just as concerned about the pit bulls as the feral bulls.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, Are officials saying don't hike there? It's too dangerous?
Actually, as I understand it, just recently, just a month and a half ago or a few months ago, the Whitewater Canyon area, and I believe over in some of the monument, was actually closed to the public for a week or two because of these reports of wild dogs taking down feral cattle. That's an area that usually remains open except for catastrophic mudslides and things like that. But in this case, it was because all hell breaking loose.
Yeah. So what's going to happen? Are they going to round up or try to round up the cattle and get rid of them?
Unfortunately, as I understand it, it's not that easy. The terrain is so steep. The animals are so elusive. And the area consists of myriad regulations and laws and borders of agencies, neighboring agencies. So there's no you can't just go in and easily get rid of these animals because the rules and regulations of all these agencies have to be met before anyone goes in there, say with a gun or even cowboys attempting to bring, corral the animals or rope them and do whatever they're going to do with them. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management, which controls the lower desert regions and foothill areas where most of these animals have been hanging out and wreaking havoc, they're only just beginning to put together a plan to get in there and do something about it. Some locals and some hikers, including members of the Bighorn Sheep Society and also the Pacific Crest Trail Association, they're getting arrested. They're frustrated. They want these animals dealt with yesterday, and the government is just moving far too slow for them.
Louisa Hagen, reporter for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll review new movies, including Red Sparrow, which stars Jennifer Lawrence as a ballerina turned spy. And Shape of Water is the favorite at the Oscars this Sunday, but could Get Out or Lady Bird pull out surprise wins?
There's no way that that is a lesser film than Dunkirk, which is a structural mess.
I agree with you, and I hope she wins. I'm prepared that she won't, but I hope she does.
An Oscar preview and movie reviews next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Hollywood's big weekend is finally here. The Oscars are on Sunday, and we'll have a preview in a moment. But first, let's get some film reviews of some new releases out this weekend. Roth Cornett is editor-in-chief of Screen Junkies News. Hey there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. And Amy Nicholson, host of the podcast The Canon. Hey, Amy.
Hello.
All right. First, Red Sparrow, starring Jennifer Lawrence as a ballerina turned secret agent.
I was told to take a man to a hotel. They said that he was an enemy of the state.
Take off your dress.
And in exchange, my mother would get the doctor she needed. Instead, they cut his throat. There could be no witnesses. So they gave me a choice. Die or become a sparrow.
Okay. Is that accent Russian, Amy? Is that what we're... thinking?
Yes. Ish? She's a Bolshoi ballerina, if you could hear her flexibility in her voice as well.
And what is a sparrow?
A sparrow. It's an intimidating name, right?
Yeah.
A sparrow means that you're basically a James Bond girl, the type of Russian spy who shows up, is not the hero, is not an action star, but seduces the American agent and then gets killed for it. So they're disposable, beautiful women who go to the, and men, who go to the school where they learn how to just give up their bodies, think of their bodies as a weapon of the state.
Wow.
Yeah, it is very sexually aggressive in a fascinating, cold, strange, unnerving way that I can imagine a lot of people are going to be covering their eyes or yelling about how problematic it is. And I really liked it.
You really liked it? You're sort of wincing as you're saying that.
I was. This was the movie I least wanted to see if you had asked me like a week ago. Because I really hate this genre where like a strong female character is just a chick in a tight skirt with a gun. Mm-hmm. There is at least not that much gunplay here. She's a very smart woman. She's been shoved into this and it's all about her brains figuring her way out of it and how to keep a controlled portion of herself that nobody gets to touch. Usually these blank women drive me nuts, but it works here.
It sounds
because
a little like Atomic Blonde.
It does, but it's so much better. I mean, Atomic Blonde is like, oh, it's just a coincidence that Charlize Theron is like a tremendous jujitsu spy and looks like Charlize Theron. Here, it's Jennifer Lawrence is picked out because she looks like Jennifer Lawrence. And at least that honesty of it makes me like the film a little more.
Roth?
I think that the aspects of the film that I like are the ones that you're describing, which is the most interesting part of the film is the sex academy in which Charlotte Rampling teaches the students how to manipulate their targets by identifying exactly what they want and becoming that thing. But what doesn't work for me about the film is the structure, which is that it essentially tells you what's going to happen. So there, it's wildly predictable. It's plotting. It's too long. The accents are, as you mentioned, a bit uneven for some of the characters, particularly Jeremy Irons, actually. Hmm. He does not hold on to that accent. But what I like about it is I think, unintentional, which is that it's kind of commenting about this moment in time, and it didn't plan to do that.
Moment being Me Too.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that probably Francis Lawrence, who worked with Jennifer Lawrence on The Hunger Games, was more playing into the idea of Jennifer Lawrence and how we have tried to own her and her sexuality and manipulate her sexuality. And
it's true. She's given interviews about how much this relates to her own private nude photos getting released on the internet.
Exactly. And she, in the movie, is given the opportunity to aggressively dare you to sexualize her and sort of take that back. And that's sort of the empowerment moment of the movie. But it weirdly fetishizes what it's commenting on at the same time.
Well, and it's also saying, I mean, just by looking at the preview, that women should be as violent as men can be.
I'm with Amy. It's not actually particularly action-driven or violent, which, certain moments are violent by necessity, but that's not necessarily what it's about. But it's also not a good spy thriller.
I thought it was. I mean, this is based on a series of books written by a man who was actually in the CIA for 33 years. And so the books themselves are more about almost the banality of the tradecraft of it, you know, what it's like to lose a tail. And they get you into that mindset of this is really what it feels like, which means I have no idea if Red Sparrows are real, because that seems strange. And also in the book, she had synesthesia. That was her superpower. But I admire the fact that this is about a CIA agent who is just as smart as she is. And they're both very smart. He's just a lot more naive. And it kind of gets into this mindset of what's the difference in mentality between a Russian spy and an American spy. And every bit of me wants to get my hackles up and say you can't generalize a population. But he's trying to say that the patriotism we say we all have here as Americans is maybe a little bit phony, that their patriotism is also phony, but they have to claim it. There's a lot of mental backflips and interesting kind of loops happening in this film that I really enjoyed.
But structurally, it's incredibly flawed as a spy drama. Joel Edgerton, who plays the American CIA agent, is terrible at his job. And wildly naive, you would not get that far in the CIA. If you were that naive, you would just simply be dead.
I don't think he's that naive. I mean, she tries to seduce him in a sex pot swimsuit, the kind of thing you'd expect to see like Xenia on the top wearing in a James Bond film. And that swimsuit is so obvious, he's just onto her right away. He's like, I know who you are.
And then he risks his life for an enemy of his state. It just, none of it makes sense to me. I really think that as the structure of the, and also just.
Because, but doesn't love Trump national boundaries? Come on.
No.
Okay, let's move on to what might be its polar opposite, Death Wish, starring Bruce Willis. It's a remake of the 1970s Charles Bronson series. Here's a clip.
I love my family. But when they needed me most.
911, what is your emergency?
There's men, they're breaking into my house. I think they're here.
No.
I failed to protect them.
Dad, where's Mom?
The men who did it are out there.
So there's nothing that you can do? Is that what you're saying?
If a man really wants to protect what's his,
I want to buy a gun.
He has to do it for himself.
Okay, so it's Bruce Willis as a vigilante.
Mm-hmm.
We saw this play out with Clint Eastwood, with Charles Bronson.
Yeah.
Bernie Getz in real life.
Yes, and it is profoundly broken as a movie. I mean, it is poorly written. Bruce Willis is phoning it in as an actor. It's clear he doesn't think anyone is actually going to see the movie. Thrown into sharp relief in any scene he's in with Vincent D'Onofrio, who is, whatever he's in, he's actually acting and performing in it. So it's a bad movie, but it's more than that, a very disturbing movie. And similarly and different than Red Sparrow, it's unconsciously commenting about what's happening right now, because it's this trope of the good guy with a gun. And it's this fantasy of revenge and a vigilante who is the person that can wield the gun and stop the bad guys. But the problem with that is that in the moment that we're in right now, culturally, it is inadvertently making a statement. And it knows that. So it backs off here and there, and in different ways seems to say, well, maybe this is problematic, or maybe Bruce Willis is literally the only one that could do this. A copycat would get killed. You can't do it. But there were cheers in the theater that I was in at moments of I'll say this is a small spoiler for the film. It is a straight execution of someone that is just doing a carjacking. I'm not saying that's not a violent crime. I'm not saying I wouldn't be traumatized if I was a victim of it. But it was very disturbing to watch. And again, it is 100% fetishizing violence and gunplay, far worse than anything Red Sparrow does at all. And the read on both of those films is more disturbing to me almost than the films themselves, if I'm honest.
Yeah. I mean, interesting that it's coming out right now as we are grappling with gun control and Parkland and all of that.
Yeah, they pushed this film from November, and one of the rumors was they pushed it because of the Las Vegas shooting. Mm-hmm. But I suppose there will never be a time to release this movie right now. There's actually a scene where Bruce Willis goes to the gun shop, which we heard, and the woman who runs the gun shop wears this like low-cut camo tank top, and the mascot is this ripped coyote wolf with an eye patch. And he's like, do I need to do a lot of paperwork? And she's like, nah. Or she actually makes the sound. And you almost think, even if you're on the other side of the debate for some reason right now, even that scene says, are our gun laws really working? I mean, should this guy really be able to do this right now? And I don't want to see a Death Wish movie pretty much under any circumstances. But if I did, I'd want to see like a Paul Verhoeven Death Wish movie who could lean into the satire of this. There's no satire here. You know, it teeters on it in that one moment with the wolf logo. But otherwise, it's really about how a guy can put on a hoodie and suddenly be cool and like walk around with a gun and be a tough dude out of nowhere. What's interesting is if people have seen the original, the 1974, and with Bronson, who, by the way, like Willis makes Bronson look like an Oscar winner actor now.
Yes.
That in that film, Charles Bronson is also mad at people like Bruce Willis. He's a doctor in this film. He's a surgeon who has kind of checked out with trying to save people's lives. In the beginning, he doesn't even try to save a cop's life. He's like, it's too late. We're in Chicago. He's just going to die. And it's that institutional apathy that Charles Bronson was really mad at. Hmm. Here, this is a guy who's just pretty powerful. He's actually more part of the system. And during the film, he does things to scramble the cops even trying to solve the case, as though he's insisting on having to go it alone. It's not a me versus the world. It's just a me doing whatever I want movie.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, it totally fits into the times.
It does. And it I think you're right in that it's completely unaware of itself, because there are moments that point out how insanely easy it is to be wildly armed. And it sort of makes a joke at it about it, which feels really off for this moment.
I would respect it more if it was at least honest propaganda instead of just, I don't know, it's a gun movie, whatever, have fun.
It won't commit. It's got an identity crisis. It won't commit to either point of view.
Okay, let's get to the main show, the Oscars. So what are you expecting this Sunday? Of course, you know, Time's Up is having its moment. Jimmy Kimmel is hosting, so is that kind of odd that there's a guy hosting?
Host of the man show.
Yeah. Host of the man show. Exactly.
And that will be an opening monologue that is heavily parsed.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, so what are you looking forward to the most?
I'm going to admit this really fast and just blurt it. I'm really looking forward to seeing Kiala Settle from The Greatest Showman sing the song, This Is Me. I know that that's so ridiculous, but I've been looking forward to this moment for a long time as somebody who's seen that movie three times now.
Wow.
I think it's going to be interesting to watch the dance of it, because certainly I don't think that you're going to have, there's not a call for the women to dress in black. And at the Golden Globes, it was only women that were speaking out about Me Too. And so I'm curious if the men will have been coached by their PR for this go around to learn how to be a part of the conversation. And I do think that they're in a really tricky position, to be fair, because you don't want to sound like you're explaining the movement to the people that is part of it. But there is no way for this to work without the inclusion of men. I don't think.
You could say they always wear black because they're wearing tuxedos. But anyway, let's get to your predictions. Best picture, what do you think?
I don't know. And I love this thought. I feel like this year, when you have this mix of genre films, even genre films I don't totally love, like Shape of Water, going up against the classical war-style history picture, we're really seeing the effect of the Academy adding thousands of new voters in the last 2 years. It feels like this year there's a struggle to redefine what is an Oscar film. I think if you'd asked us what an Oscar film was 5 years ago, we'd have the exact same movie in mind. This year, all bets are off. It could be Get Out. It could be Lady Bird. It could be the Fishman is really hot movie. I mean, which I hope it isn't. It probably will be.
The Shape of Water?
Yes.
Oh, come on. It is not the Fish.
Call Me By Your Name?
I think that stands a very outside chance. I think, but the thing that's very hard to predict about Best Picture is the weird way they vote for Best Picture, because that's what throws everything out. Most people are prognosticating about either The Shape of Water or Three Billboards. Get Out maybe could sneak in there. I hope it does. That is my favorite movie of last year. It was my favorite movie the minute I saw it last year. But it's this strange voting system in which the film has to get 50%. And then if it doesn't, those votes are transferred to the second lead.
Yeah, so and it just keeps consensus. Going.
It rewards consensus. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to predict which film it's going to be.
Exactly. Because I think this year, more than any other years, each film in this lineup has passionate supporters. And they're all going to split the vote, which is why I'm stealing myself for a Sexy Fish Man win.
It may be a Sexy Fish Man. But I think there's far more to the movie than that. Personally, I enjoy that movie quite a bit.
Could Best Picture and Director be split?
I think they will be, actually. I feel like Jordan Peele is going to pick up an award. If it's not going to be original screenplay, it could be director. I think that's very likely. I think he's going to walk home with something, and that's exciting.
Greta
I think
Gerwig?
He's going to get screenplay. I don't know that he will get director. I really think Guillermo's going to get director. I hope she does. If she doesn't, I'll be so mad. Lady Bird is such a good movie, and it's so well directed. I heard the weirdest thing yesterday where a critic said, oh, well, if you think about how the movie that's been the most directed, and this is the term they used, it's Dunkirk.
But see, I think that is what makes people win. And it annoys me. It's almost like editing is always the most edited film. Costumes is always the most costumes in a film.
But what does that even mean?
It just means that people look and they're like, oh, wow, he had to do with costume sets and special effects and period effects. He clearly thought about this and they give it to him. And I think they overlook what Greta Gerwig does, which is not
so
fair.
Masterful.
But it's the art of really getting a performance out of an actor. I feel like that's historically a little bit why female films have been shortchanged in Best Directors, because nobody respects the work they do. They're more excited in the explosions and the old suits and the cufflinks.
Yeah, but you know what? It's not just the performances. It's certainly the performances. Look at what Laurie Metcalf does in the movie, but it's also the tone and, frankly, the shot design. That movie could have fallen to a very frustrating, self-indulgent place in lesser hands. It is so deftly directed, so masterfully and profoundly specifically directed. There's no way that that is a lesser film than Dunkirk, which is a structural mess.
I agree with you, and I hope she wins. I'm prepared that she won't, but I hope she does.
Okay, speaking of great performances, Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty are going to be back together again presenting Best Picture. Hopefully having their do-over and doing it right.
Warren, what did you do?
I want to tell you what happened. I opened the envelope, and it said, Emma Stone, La La Land. That's why I took such a long look.
I hope that Faye Dunaway makes a joke.
I wasn't trying to be funny.
I mean, I felt bad for Faye and Warren Beatty last year because everybody immediately got ageist about it and they thought, oh, they're just scrambling right. And everything. I loved how afterwards Faye Dunaway just sort of shrugged and said, it wasn't my problem. I mean, what a diva moment. I mean, I want them to get the awards right this year, but if she gets a diva moment, I'll be happy about it.
Amy Nicholson, host of the podcast The Canon. Roth Cornett is editor-in-chief of Screen Junkies News. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, L.A. has a new pro soccer team. The Los Angeles Football Club has yet to play its first game, but it already has a fan base. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The atmosphere in the huge soccer stadiums around the world can be electric. Well, here in L.A., we have a new soccer team. It's L.A. Football Club, or LAFC. The team is brand new, but its supporters are already getting into the spirit. LAFC is playing its first league game this Sunday up in Seattle, and about 500 fans are flying up to watch the game and sing their own chants, like this one.
Sha-la-la-la-la-la-la, LAFC. And then it goes like that for, you know, about three or four of those same stanzas. And then until the last one, everybody just erupts and is singing that same thing.
That's LAFC fan Mark Rojas and a group of supporters at a preseason game in Sacramento. Mark came by the studio yesterday to talk to our own Christian Bordahl. And Christian's here to talk about it. Resident Norwegian, no more resident Angelino and footballer. Hello.
Yes. Hi there.
Okay. So this brand new team already has a hearty band of supporters.
Pretty amazing, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, when he said there's going to be 500 people flying up from LA to Seattle to watch that game, I was pretty blown away. I mean, in Europe, that's not unusual. You know, hundreds, even thousands of people will get on coaches and planes and fly from, you know, London up to Liverpool to watch Tottenham play up there or something. And that happens all the time. But here, for a brand new team to get that kind of thing happening, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And part of the reason, I think, is because they have done a good job of involving fans right from the beginning of creating the team. But also, they got some big names involved, like Mia Hamm and Noba Garcia-Parra, her husband, and Magic Johnson. And Will Farrell is also a part owner, and he's been talking up the team a lot. In fact, he did so on Jimmy Fallon not too long ago.
The way I'm going to model my role as an owner is kind of a George Steinbrenner type.
Yeah.
I'm going to wear a lot of turtlenecks and sports coats.
Sure, that's smart.
And hire and fire one manager like 10 times in one season.
There's also some other deep-pocketed people involved, like Tony Robbins, Hollywood mogul Peter Guber, Chad Hurley, who's the co-founder and former CEO of YouTube.
Which is a big sponsor of the team, right?
Big sponsor of the team. Mark was wearing his jersey when he came in yesterday, and it's a black and gold jersey and it has a huge YouTube logo on the chest. It looks like you're playing for Team YouTube.
So can you only watch it on YouTube?
So local games, you have to have a YouTube TV subscription, which is $40 a month. Although that Seattle game this Sunday, you can watch that, I think, on ESPN or whatever.
You really do have to be loyal to pay that.
I think you do.
Okay, and there's a new stadium, right?
There's a new stadium. And the fun thing about the new stadium, it's beside the Coliseum. It's an exposition park. It's called the Bank of California. They spent $350 million on it, is what they said the budget is. The most expensive soccer stadium in the country. It has a capacity of 22,000 people, and they've already sold out all of the season tickets. 17,500 tickets they put aside for season tickets, and they've sold them out. And one of the cool things that they did, Mark told me about, is they set up this sort of special section for home fans behind one of the goals.
One of the unique features of the stadium is the north end, where myself and a bunch of my compatriots are going to be jumping around and singing, is what they call safe standing, meaning the seats that are there will be locked up in place, and there will just be a rail for us to stand and, you know, be able to move around, rather than have, you know, be inhibited by a seat back.
So that's actually that's, as I think you said, that's patterned on a number of different famous places in Europe. Like in Liverpool at Anfield, they have this thing called the Kop End. And that's one end of the field where all of the most rabid fans are hanging out. And, you know, they make a ton of noise. And there's always a special buzz about the team scoring at the Kop End of Anfield.
But is that also a way to sequester the two rowdy fans, if you know what I mean?
I think that could be a part of it, yes. And there's this amazing place called the Yellow Wall. And Germany's team, Borussia Dortmund, have this Yellow Wall. And it's literally like 25,000 fans in this, all of them with yellow banners and flags and wearing yellow, and they make incredible amounts of noise. And that can be really intimidating, you know, for teams that go into play there.
Trying to get the ball down the field, and they see that.
Exactly.
Oh. Well, we do have another team in L.A., the L.A. Galaxy.
We do indeed,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, so I guess you could have two soccer teams.
We've got two football teams. You would call American them football. American
football,
yes.
Yeah, in one city. I guess you could, yeah.
Well, it's funny. It's kind of fortunate timing in a way for LAFC because you can think, I mean, if you think back about like the David Beckham, Landon Donovan era of the Galaxy, like trying to get another team going then, I think would be really difficult, you know? But the Galaxy have been going through kind of a down period. They didn't even get into the playoffs last season. And so in a way, the LAFC are fortunate that they're doing this right now because you know, it's easier, I think, to get some of those soccer fans interested.
Right. So will LAFC be competitive in a real way, which means with other countries?
Yeah. Well, with other teams in the MLS where they're mm-hmm. playing. And they do have some really strong international players. I mean, it's a bit early to tell whether they're really going to gel as a team and how long that will take. But they have a great Mexican star forward, this guy Carlos Vela, who's going to be going to the World Cup with the Mexican national team. He's already scored some goals for them. They also have this young guy, this young Uruguayan striker who's about to turn 20 years old. His name is Diego Rossi, and everyone is really excited to see what he can do. They are both what's called designated players, which is a special thing that MLS has because it's so expensive to get international stars. You know, like David Beckham apparently made something like $50 million over the 5 years that he was with the Galaxy. Everyone else made a lot less.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a salary cap in the MLS, and so you get three designated players that don't count against that salary cap. So those are two of the guys, and then they still have another salary cap, a designated player that they can pick.
And who's the coach?
Coach is a guy named Bob Bradley, used to coach the U.S. national team, had a very brief and not so fortunate tenure in the English Premier League, but he's back here stateside now and coaching this team.
And a lot of Hispanic soccer fans here in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Is the team trying to reach out to them?
Of course.
Get them involved?
Absolutely. And in fact, Mark had a special chant for them.
Oh.
Qué bonito es. Eso es nuestro amor. Yo nací aquí. Vamos LAFC.
There you go.
I think he sings better in Spanish.
I think he does.
Okay. Well, so the LA is also trying to get the World Cup in 2026.
Yes. Exciting, huh?
So this seems to be a soccer town.
It does seem to be a soccer town. You know, there were some contractual issues that were kind of holding the city back from signing on to that. But now Anschutz Entertainment, the LA Rams, and LAFC have got together and they created their own little company between them that's going to handle this for the city. And that got the city to sign the contract. And so LA could be one of 12 cities across the country that would host games for the 2026 World Cup. The U.S. would have 60 games, Mexico would take 10 games, and Canada would take 10 games.
Okay, so that and the Olympics? It's a sports town.
We are a sports town, absolutely.
What about chanting? What about a chant town? Do you have another one?
we have one more chant that we can go out. Here's Mark again.
When I see LAFC, I go out of my head, and I just can't get enough. And I just can't get enough, you know, and then go along and then do, 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 do,
LAFC.
Okay. Christian Bordahl, sounds like you're already a super fan yourself.
Not yet, but I'm going to go watch some games, definitely.
All right. Press Play senior producer Christian Bordahl. Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. That's it for Press Play this Friday and for this week. Our show is directed by Sarah Sweeney, produced by Christian Bordahl, Amy Ta, Gina Pollack, Michelle Aloy, and Yael Evan Orr. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Mario Saavedra, our audio engineer. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you on Monday.